stand head in hand, turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on feeling 2 foot small. Everywhere people stare, each and every day. I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say, got to hide your love away. Hey, you've got to hide your love away.
What was it like to be John Lennon? What was it like to be the cast-off child, the clown at school, and the middle-class suburban boy who pretended to be a working-class hero? How did it feel to have one of the most recognizable singing voices in all the world, but to dislike it so much that he always wanted to disguise it? Ray Connolly looks to answer those questions in his new book, Being John Lennon, A Restless Life. The John Lennon depicted in these pages is a much more kaleidoscopic figure, sometimes almost a collision of different characters. Again, the name of the book is Being John Lennon. Ray Connolly's previous book was Being Elvis, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ray Connolly to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you.
And for me too, dear.
The subtitle of the book, A Restless Life. What was it about this restless life that fascinated you, that wanted you to write about John Lennon?
Well, you know, John kept endlessly reinventing himself. You know, I mean, the big reinvention was when he suddenly decided to break up the Beatles, most popular people in the world, and he said, no, I've done that, I don't want to do it anymore, and decided to go off with Yoko Ono, and that was a huge, huge step, you know. He broke millions of hearts, but he did it, he didn't care. And, you know, then later on, he decided he wanted to be more of a working-class hero than he really was. He wasn't working-class at all. And so, you know, that was his new persona for a while. And then he went, and, you know, it was an endless, his entire life was just changing himself, you know. At first he was a rock and roll Chuck Berry fanatic. Then he thought, no, I want to be an avant-garde artist. It was all that sort of, you know, restlessness in his, all through his life.
What was it that you felt was missing in biographies of this man that you wanted to address in your take, and what it was like being John Lennon?
Well, basically, I think that, you know, there's several biographies on John yet, but mainly, if not totally, by people who never knew him. I spent an awful lot of time with John for, you know, over several years. We were in touch until the day he died, you know, and I just thought that I wasn't recognizing him sometimes in some of the books I read. You know, he wasn't this martyr, he wasn't a saint, he wasn't all these things. But at the same time, he wasn't a monster, as the Albert Gorman book pointed him out to be. I just thought he was more interesting than that and more complex. And he would say himself he was a sort of a mixed personality, like a chameleon. But he would join in. Whoever he was with, he would actually suddenly begin to sort of be like them. So in a way, he was a leader, but he was very easily led. And I thought this whole area of him has not really been examined, and I knew him well enough to examine it, basically.
You have a quote in the book that says, I'm John, I play a guitar too, and sometimes I play the fool.
Yeah.
How true is that?
Oh, it's true. I mean, you know, John couldn't miss a joke if you saw one coming. Even if it's going to hurt you, he'd still say it. So, and, you know, he'd fool about all the time. He'd exaggerate crazily, just crazily. And he would, you know, he was a real one-off. He did play the fool. I mean, when they were on stage in Hamburg, he would go on stage with a lavatory seat around his neck, you know, which, you know, rock stars don't usually do, things like that. But John didn't care. I mean, I suppose it's a desperate call for attention. He liked being the center of attention all his life, and he did. He achieved that. So, There were all kinds of little things he did. You sort of think, well, why are you doing that, John? But, well, that was John. You accepted it.
Talk a little bit about the nature of your relationship, of how you met John Lennon.
I met John in 1967 for the first time. So we'd grown up about 10 miles from each other near Liverpool. He was on the south side, and I was about 10 miles in a small town further away. And then, with exactly the same age, he became a Beatle, and I'd gone to university and gone different ways. But then we both had the same interest in rock and roll, and we're both 15 when Elvis hit. That made a hell of a difference to boys of that age. So I got a job on the London Evening Standard as a journalist and was sent virtually on my first day or first week or two to follow the Magical Mystery Tour bus down to England's West Country. And so got him a little car and followed them and didn't know the Beatles. I knew Paul's father and his brother. Anyway, get down there and got to know Paul well, and then he sort of passed me on to the other guys. And John was the last, because I was a bit nervous of John, because he was, you know, had a reputation of having a sort of sharp tongue. And I was interviewing Yoko for the first time, anyone had done it in England, and in Abbey Road one night when they just got together. And John was playing Cry Baby Cry, or mixing it in the background. We just got on. And then, little by little, I got him more involved, and I found myself, you know, playing at Triangle on some of the Ghost tracks, you know, and various things. And I realized something was going on. Didn't know quite what it was. There was something going wrong with the Beatles, and no one would sort of say. And I read a big piece in the Standard saying, the day the Beatles died, really mean when they stopped touring, they were dead. And I thought, I'm going to get into real trouble with Apple and the other Beatles when this comes out, the Beatles. And the next morning, I got a rose on my desk in a white in cellophane, saying, with a letter from John and Yoko. And from that day on, I became like John's deep throat. He'd phone me with stories. He phoned me when he came back his MBE to the Queen. He phoned me to tell me that. He told me he'd left the Beatles long before it became public knowledge and Paul put it out. So things like that. That's how I got to know him. Then we became friends. He took me to Canada, to New York a couple of times. And we just got on because I knew a lot about rock and roll, and, you know, like him. And in a way, other journalists at the time weren't my age. I was John's age, exactly. You know, so that's how it worked.
When you talk about the restlessness of his life and he was always reinventing himself, did it always have to do with music? Was that the through line?
Not completely, because when he decided he wanted to be an avant-garde artist, yeah, with Yoko. I mean, he brought down the idea of the Beatles. He was an iconoclast. He destroyed them. He'd done that. He wanted to be an artist, and he called himself an artist. He didn't call himself an artist before he met Yoko. He was always a rocker. Then he was suddenly an artist. So it wasn't quite that. He saw himself also as a writer, and he was a very good writer, very clever writer. I think that's really more how he saw himself, actually. I think, you know, he was always better with words than Paul or the others, and that's how he saw himself as a writer.
So tell us about the origin story of the Beatles as far as John Lennon is concerned, of what he wanted, of what he saw of that opportunity and that experience, and then ultimately the need to get out of it.
Yeah, well, you know, for someone who was 15 in 1956, there was one aim in life, you know. I mean, I wrote a film years later, and I put in the line, show me a boy who never wanted to be a rock star, and I'll show you a liar. And John wanted to be a rock star from the day he heard Elvis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry. He wanted to do that, and that was his one aim. So he did nothing at school, was completely failure at school, failure at college. He just got obsessed with this one thing. So that's how he saw himself. Of course, then he grew up, and he sort of thought, well, I like doing that, and I love doing it, and I'm good at that, but there's got to be more in life than being a rock and roll singer, rock and roll writer. And so then he wrote a book. He wrote two or three books, actually. And then he met Yoko, and Yoko was so different and so exotic. He'd met no one ever like her in his entire life before. She was just so different. And she gave him an aura of the intelligentsia, and that's what I think he got from her, you know. It was one of the things that she made him feel intelligent, and he was intelligent, but when he's hanging out with rock stars or being interviewed by pop newspapers and things, he didn't feel that way sometimes. He felt cleverer than the people he was talking to, and he probably was in many cases. And that's what Joplin gave him. So that was the way his life was going, always.
When it comes to the effect of the music on that restless life, do we even see that? I mean, obviously we see that within the Beatles catalog, which brings up the question as to the partnership between Lennon and McCartney.
You know, they were just fantastic together. They just had everything together. And it was, I mean, it broke my heart when John told me they were breaking up, because they were never as good when they weren't together. Now and again, they'd have the odd single and things, but they weren't as good. The great thing about them was they were great editors of each other's work. I had, you know, Paul was obviously more melodically gifted and also better musician. And John often said, you know, not often, but he told me anyway, that Paul taught him quite a lot of guitar early on. And then Paul was good, but John was very clever with the words. He was very succinct, right? He'd write, you know, give peace a chance, four words. All you need is love, five words. All you need is love. Great little sort of neat phrases like that. He was very good at that. But together they helped each other. You know, they would sort of, they were great editors of each other's work. There's a theory, or people think, that they wrote together. Not a lot later on, a little bit early on, but later on they wrote separately, but then they edited each other's work endlessly. And when they were recording, you know, John would say, no, I don't like that, let's change that. Or Paul would say the same thing to John, backwards and forwards. And that made them, they were together, they were more than the sum of the two parts. They were something else. But it was to do with the editing, and also they both shared the same backgrounds in music and backgrounds in where they come from, everything. And it was, that's why they were so great. The other great thing about them was when they were singing together, and at the end they didn't do this much, but early on, Paul would sing a third over John all the time. When the Everly Brothers did that, it sounded like one voice, or Simon Garfunkel, or whatever. But when the Beatles did it, John and Paul did it, you could hear their two voices separately, distinctly, and that was exciting. That was part of the Beatles' excitement.
You have a list at the end of the book, John Lennon's Best Recordings, making the point that he recorded over 400 songs during his career, 300 of which were with the Beatles. What was it like putting that list together?
It was heaven, actually. You know, you just go through the board and play and to yourself and say, no, that wasn't. Oh, that was a good one. You know, that. But yeah, it was. It's purely personal. You'd have a different list, I'm sure. But you know, it was. I like the ones where John is really in control of it, and I love the rock and roll Chuck Berry ones he did. He was really very very good at that. He just thought, well, I can knock those off, but he was actually very good at them. Funnily enough, when he did them later on. On a rock and roll album, he wasn't as good. So then again, I think if he had someone there who was as strong as him, like Paul, who'd said, "I'm not sure about that," you know, "why don't we do it this way?" He'd have been better. You know, we all need an editor, and that's where Paul was very useful. But it was great fun to go through and so on. And you know, things like If I Fell.
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me? Understand, 'cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands. If I give my heart to you, I must be sure from the very start that you would love me more than.
So many of them, and my favorite album would be Rubber Soul, to be honest, and that has some great songs on it from both John and Paul. Wonderful stuff.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better, some have gone and some remain. All these places had their moments with lovers and friends.
was taken from us so young, of just a very young man who was shot down in what may not have been his musical prime, although who knows?
Well, we'll never know. It was one of those terrible moments. I was due to go and see him. I'd been trying to arrange a meeting. I mean, we hadn't spoken for about 5 years when he'd been with... He'd gone into sort of like hibernation to bring up Sean. And then he came out and made that final album. And when I heard about it, so I got in touch and got Yoko to say, well, don't come now. Give us a couple of weeks and then we'll organize it. And she didn't call back, so I forgot about it. And then on the day John died, he went to get a haircut. And the BBC had been over to see him the day before. And they'd said, who's coming? He said, oh, Ray Conley's coming. And Yoko said, oh, so Yoko rang me and said, we thought you were coming over. Where are you? I said, oh, I'll come tomorrow. Okay. So I went home and I got the record out and played it again, the new record, and then bought my airline ticket and everything. And my children were very excited. I'm going to go see John Lennon the next day. Can you imagine?
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown, although our love is still special. Let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone.
Before I went to sleep that night, I phoned the Dakota and said, that's like 11 o'clock our time, so it's whatever time it is in New York, you know, and said, I'll be over on the first plane tomorrow morning. And I got the answer from, I got someone, an assistant who said, oh, hi, Ray. John says to come straight to the Dakota when you get in from the airport. He's looking forward to seeing you. I said, great, I'm looking forward to seeing him. But they'd gone to the studio to remix one of Yoko's tracks. I said, oh, okay, I'll see him tomorrow. And put the phone down, and that was like 11:30 our time, around 12. At 4:30, the phone went, and I thought it was a taxi coming to take me to the airport, having come too early. And it wasn't. It was another journalist somewhere else in New York thing that said, have you heard that John Lennon's been shot? I said, no, I'm going to go and see him. I'm going to go and see him in a few hours. He said, no, he's been shot. Well, is he hurt? Is he badly hurt? So I don't know. And so I got up and... It's very hard, to understand the sudden change. And went downstairs and put on the BBC World Service. In those days, you didn't have 24-hour news apart from the World Service. And it was confirmed at 5 o'clock that our time that he was dead. And, years earlier, John had asked me if I'd written his obituary yet. And, of course, I hadn't. We were still in our 20s. And then suddenly I found myself sitting down to write an obituary of the man I was meant to go and see that day. It was a very hard day.
And it seems impossible, even in words, to tell the story of a person's life, especially someone who touched so many people in so many different ways.
Yeah, it is. And what I was just trying to do was to make sure, I was trying to be as honest as I could. And some people over here in England have said, he wasn't very nice. Well, he wasn't very nice all the time, but he was terrific with me, and we got on really well. But I wanted to be honest. I wanted to be honest about him and Yoko and him and May Pang, his mistress for a while, and he treated his wife very badly. I wanted to be honest about that because I liked her a lot. I liked May, I liked his first wife, Cynthia. I liked Paul a lot, and I wanted to do that. And so that's what I did. So, I was very fond of him, but I could see his faults. I wanted his faults to be aired, not to be what. I didn't want him to be a martyr, a prince of peace, or, into eternity, because he wasn't. He was, he was John Lennon. He was a mixture of people. He was a leader who was actually easily led, I always felt. He got led by some very silly people, but, we all do some silly things too.
The name of the new book is Being John Lennon, A Restless Life. It is published by Pegasus. Ray Connolly, I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you.
Again, the name of the book is Being John Lennon, A Restless Life. It's published by Pegasus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. I'm sick and tired of hearing things.